is Thursday, May 21st, and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Alana Hill. Samsung Electronics chip workers could receive up to 600 million won in bonuses under a tentative deal reached Wednesday. More on that in news briefing. On In Depth, we examine the deal, the union vote ahead, and what the dispute means for profit sharing, government intervention, and labor relations in Korea's AI chip boom. And on Explore Korea, we introduce contemporary artist An Jun-young and his exhibition, Black Eyelids. Let's start Korea 24 right now. Labor and management at Samsung Electronics have reached a tentative 11th-hour wage agreement and prevented a massive 18-day general strike. Our KBS World Radio news reporter, Bae Ji-yeon, joins us now in the studio to give us the latest on this story and other headlines of the day. Hello, Ji-yeon.
Hello, Alana.
So the deal on wages and collective bargaining came about an hour before more than 47,000 workers were scheduled to walk off the job. Ji-yeon, what were the highlights of the deal?
The two sides have agreed to allocate 12% of the profit from the company's semiconductor business for bonuses over the next 10 years. Specifically, 10.5% of an agreed-upon performance figure will be set aside as special bonuses for the Device Solutions Unit, with no cap on the payout rate, and 1.5% for an existing bonus called the Overall Performance Incentive.
So just how much are workers expected to get in bonuses this year with this deal?
Workers in the semiconductor unit will likely receive up to 600 million won. That's around $400,000 this year. Workers in non-semiconductor units, which are likely to see deficit this year, could receive at least 160 million won in bonuses. That's around $106,000. Take note that the Device Solutions bonuses will be paid for this year through 2028, so long as the company generates 200 trillion won in annual operating profit and 100 trillion won between 2028 and 2035. The union said it will put the tentative deal to a vote that will start Friday and continue for 6 days. If the union's members vote to accept the agreement, the five-month impasse between Samsung and its labor union will finally come to an end.
Well, thanks to this deal, the benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index surged over 8% to recover to the 7,800 mark. Ji-yeon, tell us a bit about that.
The KOSPI jumped 606.64 points, or 8.42% on Thursday, to close at 7,815.59. Also following the deal, the electronics giant's stock price closed at a record 299,501, up 8.51% from the previous session.
Now let's turn to some political news. The top office has hailed the release of two South Korean activists who were apprehended by Israeli forces aboard aid ships heading to Gaza.
Yes, Cheongwade spokesperson Kang Yoo-jung said during a press briefing that the Lee Jae-myung administration welcomes the release of the South Korean nationals and appreciates Israel's action on the matter. However, the government still expressed strong regret over Israel's capture and detention of the South Koreans. The Koreans' release comes a day after President Lee said during a cabinet meeting that the Koreans' apprehension was inhumane and asked Israel on what legal grounds it had done so.
Shifting gears now to the June 3rd local elections. Today, campaign for these elections and by-elections kicked off, with the candidates set to curry voter support for the next 13 days. Ji-yeon, give us the details.
A total of 4,227 positions will be filled in the local elections. That's including 16 heads of major cities and provinces, 227 leaders of other cities, districts and counties, and 14 parliamentary seats in the by-elections. The ruling Democratic Party is striving to secure seats in the conservative opposition stronghold in the southeastern Gyeongsang region, while the main opposition People Power Party seeks to win over moderates. Early voting will be open between 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. on Friday and Saturday of next week.
Now let's take a look at a new KBS poll on voter sentiment ahead of the elections. What did this poll find?
The KBS poll conducted by Hangul Research from Saturday to Wednesday surveyed voter sentiment in seven metropolitan governments, including Seoul, Busan, and Daegu. Asked which candidate they would vote for in the Seoul mayoral race, 45% of the respondents chose the ruling Democratic Party's Jeong Won-ho, while 34% backed People Power Party's candidate Oh Se-hoon, putting the gap at 11 percentage points. That's outside the margin of error. In the mayoral race in the southeastern city of Busan, DP candidate Jeon Jae-suk garnered 45% support, while incumbent mayor Park Hyung-jun of the PPP received 33%. Meanwhile, the Daegu mayoral race tightened significantly, with DP candidate Kim Bu-geom at 40% and PPP's candidate Choo Kyung-ho at 39%. The survey on mayoral races conducted on 800 adults in each city had a 95% confidence level and a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points.
Thanks for those headlines, Ju-yeon.
Thanks, Alana.
And for our last story for today's news briefing, we are turning to the football match between a North Korean team and a South Korean team that happened Wednesday evening in the semifinals of the AFC Women's Champions League. For that, we have now on the line Yoo Ji-ho, sports reporter at Yonhap News Agency, who was on the grounds at Suwon Stadium in Suwon. Hi, Ji-ho.
Hi.
Ji-ho, let's start with the match itself. How exactly did Naego Hyung from North Korea beat South Korea's Suwon FC women 2-1? And what were some of the key moments?
Yeah, so I think it was a good match. Just in terms of pure football perspective, it was a pretty good match, I think. A lot of back and forth, a plenty of action, especially in the second half. You know, Suwon FC women dominated the first half. They hit the goalpost twice. The shot counts after the first half was 10-1 in Suwon's favor. And Haruhi Suzuki got the first goal for Suwon 4 minutes into the second half. And they seemed like, you know, it seemed like they had all the momentum behind them. But then Choi Gu-mok equalized just a few minutes later for Naego Hyung with a header before Kim Jong-young got the goal in the 67th minute. And for Suwon, their captain, Ji So-yeon, missed a penalty in the 79th minute that would have tied the match and possibly sent it to extra time. So it wasn't meant to be. She managed to fool the goalkeeper, but was not able to score into the empty net there. So some disappointing ending for Suwon on their home soil, but come from behind win by Naego Hyung on this rainy, kind of cold, and if I'm being honest, it was kind of miserable out there. It was pretty cold out there, but the players gave their best effort, and I think they put on a really good show.
I was just about to say, Ji-ho, it was luckily an exciting game, because I imagine for fans at Suwon FC that it was quite a bit of a miserable experience, as you said, with that really heavy rain last night. How would you assess Naego Hyung's overall performance?
Yeah, so I think in the first half, they looked overmatched. But at the same time, you know, Suwon, they play with so much pace that it wasn't going to be sustainable for the entire match. And it looked like Naego Hyung players might have been pacing themselves a little bit in the first half. And in the second half, once they got the equalizer relatively soon after giving up the first goal, you know, they're really opportunistic. They scored on a free kick the first time and capitalized on a defensive miscue by Suwon for the second goal. This is still a very young team. A lot of players in their early to mid-20s, but they've got several players who have experienced winning on international stages. For example, you know, this is the North Korean national team. They won the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup titles in 24 and 25, and they also captured the Under-20 Women's World Cup crown back in 2024. And Naego Hyung have some players who were on those national teams, Under-17, Under-20 teams. And, you know, more recently, they also won the Women's Under-20 Asian Cup and the Under-17 Women's Asian Cup in the last couple of years as well. So, you know, their national team programs have been very successful, especially in the underage groups. And Naego Hyung they do feature several players who played on those winning teams.
Mm-hmm. And this was more than just an AFC Women's Champions League final. It was kind of historic in the sense that it was the first visit by a North Korean women's football team to South Korea in 12 years. Ji-ho, what was the atmosphere like at the stadium? You know, were there organized cheering squads? How did the crowd respond to both these teams?
Yeah, so apparently about 7,000 tickets were sold, but only about 5,700 people showed up, and which is, I guess, kind of understandable given the weather conditions here, you know, on Wednesday night. But a lot of the supporters were actually behind Naego Hyung. Suwon FC women, they had their own supporters, but they were outnumbered by the members of South Korean civic groups. Some of them representing South Korean residents and nationals who were born north of the border, mm-hmm. but had to leave their home during the Korean War and et cetera. So, those people had sort of the connection with the North Korean athletes and their team. So, I think the crowd overall was decidedly pro-North Korea. It was not really a neutral match at all. In fact, I mean, you know, this is the Suwon's stomping ground. This is their own home stadium, but it seemed like Naegoyang had a lot more support behind them from the fans in the stand.
Let's talk a bit more about the players. We saw video footage of the North Korean players arriving at Incheon Airport over the weekend. They appeared to be quite reserved, you know, even as there was, as you said, Jiho civic groups there cheering them on. Did they seem similarly closed off at the stadium, or were they more relaxed once that kind of match started? And did you notice any interactions between the North Korean and South Korean players?
Yeah, there was some interaction. Right before the kickoff, the players from each side, they high-fived each other before acknowledging the referees on the field. So, you know, high-fiving kind of casually on the field before the kickoff. And even after the final whistle, some players, not all of them, but some players, you know, high-fived each other. Suwon players congratulating Naegoyang players on their victory. But like you said, you know, off the field has been a different story. Coming through the airport via Beijing, you know, they were greeted by hundreds of South Korean supporters, but the players did not really acknowledge them.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, coming in and out of the team hotel in Suwon, you know, fans were camped out there trying to get a glimpse of the North Korean athletes. But again, the athletes didn't really acknowledge them. So, and also right after the match, we did have the official press conference, but other players coming through the mix zone, they did not answer any questions from the South Korean media. So, as far as on the field, right before and after the matches, there was a little bit of interaction between the players from the two sides.
Jiho, tell us a bit more about that press conference that took place after the final whistle. What did each side say?
Yeah, so with the North Korean team, head coach Lee Yoo-il said he was pleased with the way his players came back after going down 1-0. He did not like the way they played in the first half, but they were able to regroup in time for the second half. And he also pointed out that he felt South Korean's passion for the game is pretty impressive. You know, the day before the pre-match press conference, he said he wasn't going to think too much about having South Korean supporters because he was only here to play football. And his team was here to play football. But after the match, he had to admit, you know, the support was, pretty impressive in his mind. Now, with the South Korean club, the Suwon FC Women, their coach Park Il-young admitted that he felt a little hurt, disappointed that, you know, they were playing on their home soil, but they didn't get as much support as the other team who were visiting from North Korea. So, you know, he and his players maybe would have appreciated a little more support from the home crowd, but. Mm-hmm. And also, they wanted to deliver a victory in front of them, but they weren't able to get it done.
Mm-hmm. Well, by beating Suwon FC 2-1, Naegoyang, they now advance to the final of the AFC Women's Champions League. Jiho, tell us a bit more about that. What can we expect?
Yeah, it's going to be against the Tokyo Verdy Bellezza of Japan. 2 p.m. kickoff on Saturday back at Suwon Stadium. You know, these two teams actually met during the group stage in November last year, with Tokyo beating Naegoyang 4-0. Two goals by Moka Hiwatari and a goal each by Yuzuho Shiokoshi and Miharu Shinjo. And Shiokoshi and Shinjo also scored in their Wednesday's win over Melbourne City FC in the other semifinal match. So Tokyo had that sort of history against, in favor of themselves as far as having beaten Naegoyang before. But I think this should be a little closer than the last meeting. Naegoyang also, like I mentioned earlier, will likely have a pretty partisan crowd behind them. So it might feel like their home match come final on Saturday.
Well, hopefully it'll be another exciting game and some better weather for fans heading out to see that match, that final match on Saturday. That's where we'll wrap up today's news briefing. Yonhap News Agency sports reporter Yoo Ji-ho, thanks so much for filling us in on all the details from the game.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Hi, my name is Jocelyn Clark. I'm the first official non-Korean licensee of Gayagum Sanjo in Korea. You are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Samsung Electronics reached a last-minute tentative deal with its union on Wednesday night, averting an 18-day strike that had been set to begin Thursday. Under the deal, Samsung agreed to allocate 12% of profits from its semiconductor business to bonuses over the next 10 years. Workers in the memory unit could receive up to 600 million won, or about $400,000 this year, while employees in non-memory semiconductor units are guaranteed a minimum bonus of 160 million won. The union will put the agreement to a six-day vote starting Friday, and if approved, it would end a five-month impasse between Samsung and its labour union. To help us analyse the situation and understand the implications for the company, union and shareholders, we're joined today by two guests. First, Professor Yang Jun-suk of the Catholic University of Korea. Hello, Professor Yang.
Hello.
And political commentator Sung Seo-ryun, a former law professor at Kyunghee University. Great to have you with us, Professor Sung.
Happy to join you.
Well, let's start with the deal itself. Professor Yang, what's your take on the tentative agreement between Samsung Electronics Labor Union and the company?
Well, there is some relief because there will be no strike. There will be no massive hits to the growth rate, at least for this year. And uncertainty has been reduced. But there are some medium-term and longer-term consequences of this decision, especially if it spreads to other companies, that is somewhat worrying. For example, the Samsung Labor Union now has a guarantee, at least for the next 10 years, that they will get 12.5% of profits from Samsung, and that may create a misbalance between investors and entrepreneurs and labor. Since labor is taking a cut out of profit, which is risky, which is has been, at least according to traditional market economics, somewhat reserved for people who take risk, like investors. And then there may be increasing income disparity between people who have good jobs and people who are in bad jobs. So it'll worsen Korea's dual labor market structure. It will also mean that large part of Samsung's profit last year and this year, frankly, came from luck. Mm-hmm. It came from overseas AI rallied massive demand. It seems like everybody wants a piece of this pie, mm-hmm. not just the labor unions, but the government, everybody. And it worries me somewhat that people tend to look at this profit as more of a communal property than something that was earned by the company and the investors.
Mm-hmm. Professor Song, what's your assessment of the agreement between the two sides?
Well, the fact that the massive stoppage of work has been averted, it's a positive development. I think that it show that the major labor unions have the right to have a collective bargaining and collective actions, and it worked. And management has acknowledged that if there are some profits, there are some good reasons to share those the profits in a very equitable way. I think the question remains, as Professor Yang laid out, this is whether this would be sustainable going forward. That would be a different question. But frankly, this is what the advanced countries solve their problems when there are issues between the management and the labor. They exercise their rights, and they come to some sort of deal so that they would be the major disaster is averted, which is exactly what happened now.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear for our listeners, this is a tentative agreement. It still has to be put to a union vote that will actually start tomorrow. Professor Song, do you expect union members to approve it?
I think there's a reasonable expectation that the union members approve it. Although, as you said, nothing is guaranteed. The reason that both sides have a good reason to come to an end of it is because both sides have already invested a substantial political institutional capital into reaching this tentative deal. Once the negotiations reached this level, after intense public attention, not only domestic but a global attention, union leadership also faces pressure to show members that tangible gains will be achieved without triggering a prolonged strike, or some could be anticipating a disaster if the strike has prolonged and destroy what they have under supply and the global level and a very, very high level of profit. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, many members are aware that the broader economic uncertainty facing the semiconductor industry is global in nature. Even if the profits remain large, the market cycle is volatile. So they recognize that this is the time to kind of cash in, not hold out for a larger profit.
Professor Yang, do you think this deal has enough support among union members to pass?
Right now, it seems so. The problem is Samsung is such a large, diversified company that they have many different divisions which are handled completely separate, different type of production, different type of output. So people who make smartphones or appliances, they will get some bonus, but it will mostly be under the old structure, so they will not really gain from this contract all that much. Even people within the semiconductor division, the so-called DES division, if you work at the foundries, if you work at the so-called system chips, the CPUs and graphic GPUs, you won't be getting as much of a bonus as much as people who work with memory chips. Neither probably will be the people who work in R&D. So there is a lot of distrust and perhaps anger within the company between different divisions. But overall, because they are getting at least some bonuses, which are higher than what they used to get, I think there will be a lot of reluctant support, but the semiconductor division, DS division, has majority of employees, so it will probably pass.
Negotiations over pay at Samsung have opened a wider debate over labor rights, management rights and shareholder interests. President Lee Jae-myung also weighed in on this matter during the wage talks, saying unions have the right to collective action, but that there should be limits, especially when demands involve a share of pre-tax operating profit. Professor Yang, what are your thoughts on this debate?
Okay, I think the initial position of the labor union was that they want to have the gains of an investor without the risks. And I think that would have been very dangerous in the medium and long term for Korea's investment entrepreneurship in the future. And let me explain what I mean by that. The labor unions wanted a cut 15% from operating profit. That's a profit that comes before taxes, before extraordinary profits. Now, traditionally, this type of profit has been reserved for investors because investors take the risk. When there's losses, investors take the losses. But here, the union was basically saying we want the 15% of profit before everybody else. So they were putting themselves in perhaps a superior position than the investors. And investors, I think, were justifiably angry. Government also, I think, was a bit angry over that. Why does the first priority go to the labor instead of paying taxes? And that has been solved somewhat with the compromise solution. I think they're staying away from defining it as operating profits. And also, a lot of the bonuses will be given in terms of stocks. That means they will not be in a superior position to the investors, but on the same position as the investors or stockholders. But there is still a problem of capital dilution. More people will have stocks. That means the profit must be split into a larger number of people, so that may also have consequences as well. Stockholders are getting angry, though perhaps not as angry as before the compromise solution was offered. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole problem that comes up because of the yellow envelope law, whether subcontractors, employees from subcontracting firms can also sue for similar compensation as the Samsung employees.
Professor Song, what's your take on this debate over labor rights, management rights, and shareholder interests?
I think Professor Yang laid out very, very clearly. This is a tension that has existed from, frankly, the Industrial Revolution. But at this point, I think that it is a very interesting point in time where this AI revolution and the different ways of organizing the companies and doing the industry has made it necessary, actually, to think about different ways of dividing the profits. I think that the big question is whether this kind of profit-sharing scheme is sustainable. On one hand, this is not new. There have been different types of profit-sharing model already exists. I think the real question is not whether workers should share in success, but how to design the system in a sustainable and legally predictable way. Mm-hmm. I think what goes into it is that not only there is a business logic to go into it, the management having their rights, investors having their rights, and the laborers having their collective bargaining rights, but also there is a sense of the social legitimacy. There is a public nature, public goods nature of the industry and the workers' rights. So those things are going into the new era of AI revolution where very big swing of the profit cycles or industry cycle could create this kind of situation where extraordinary profits could happen. How to share it? And as Professor Yang mentioned, that if it's concentrated in one very small segment of the society, one company or a couple of companies, probably that social legitimacy and the public goods nature would be strained. So how do we solve these problems? How do we solve these tensions? Probably that will be not only but also a real question going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to rewind a little bit for a moment, talks appeared to collapse on Wednesday morning, but they were resumed later in the day with government mediation and eventually produced a tentative deal. Now, Professor Yang, is this level of government involvement in a private company's labor dispute common, and how do you view it?
Okay, well, in most countries, I would say no, with this caveat. Most countries want a mediation service, but not an explicit involvement by the government. This time, for Samsung, we had labor minister perhaps informally taking part in the negotiations. So you may argue that this is not a formal government intervention. But I think government intervention or government involvement in these type of negotiations are somewhat usual. So that makes Korea somewhat different from, I think, other countries. And that's because the government has a lot of extraordinary powers that may not be available, or it may not be used as often in other countries. For example, there was a lot of question on whether the government will use the emergency adjustment to force the unions to work. Now, if you have that kind of strength on your side, that cannot help but affect the negotiation. And I think in the past, what we've seen between labor and business negotiation is that they're not really negotiating with each other. They're trying to convince the government to come in and do what they want. So that the existence of government has perhaps distorted some of the labor negotiations, sometimes on the side of the labor, sometimes on the side of the management. And that brings in the political factor, which really results in a long-term sustainable compromise. And this time, though, I think there were some elements of it, but it was less than we had seen in the past. It was closer, I think, to a mediation than an active involvement, though they did hold that big stick called adjustment that would force the workers to work. So in this case, I think it was a tool that that's usually used badly, but this time I think it actually did some good. That does not necessarily mean we should maintain this method of negotiations in the future.
Professor Song, the two major umbrella labor unions, they say that Samsung's agreement should lead to profit sharing for subcontracted workers and broader social returns. How do you view that argument?
I think it is a legitimate argument because we have in Korea probably bifurcated with the two sector labor forces. One is, as you can see, very lucrative if you are in a big company laborers. But there are supply chain laborers who are just as important in the industry but have been excluded from this collective bargaining dynamics that could give them much bigger profits. I think it's an equity issue. I think it's a adjustment issue to the new ways of organizing the industry. There are a lot of gig workers. There are a lot of the supply chain companies that need to be protected. So I think that the government intervention, kind of circling back to the last question, is that normally you would say that in a private disputes between the management and the labor, the government should stay out. But no, I don't think that's the case entirely because of the social legitimacy, because of the kind of public goods nature. I think this discussion has taken on a agenda and the topic that interests everybody. Mm-hmm. So the government, I think, is a legitimate stakeholder. And what people think about how the profits are divided and shared, it's not just labor members or the company matters, but it's a kind of a national agenda. Because what happened in the Samsung labor union could happen in other industries, Kakao, Hyundai, LG, in other industries, whether they are in the AI-related industries or not. I think this is the kind of a glimpse of the future where we have to take in a kind of a sense of what could be the problem going forward, what could be a more equitable way to organize the protection of the laborers in terms of the economic rights and the labor rights. So I think those two labor unions talking about, look at us. We are excluded from the what's happening in the major labor unions. I think that has a voice into it. I think we should take some measure of interest to resolve what they think is a problem going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of going forward and the future, briefly, Professor Song, now that Samsung has avoided a strike by restructuring its bonus system, what kind of precedent will this set for other big companies and their labor unions in Korea?
I think that's the probably the next big thing. I mean, in this the struggle between the labor and main mass, I think that the SK Hynix has kind of set a little bit of precedent. But now the Samsung and now that Hynix is in the same camp in terms of profit sharing, it's going to spill over. I think that the other industries will look at it and other labor unions would look at it and say, look, there is a new model that gives a participation to the participation of profits to the laborers. As I mentioned before, this is not a new model. The Scandinavian countries have done it. European countries have, and not only the profit sharing, but the management decisions could be shared with the labor unions. So those kind of participatory management labor relationship will probably gain more voice going forward. I think that the big question is whether there is a sustainable in terms of whether this kind of big time profit may not be sustainable going forward year to year. So it might collapse if there's not enough profits to go around. So I think the spillover effect is that we have to talk about this and not just as a one-off event. It's a structural event.
Before we wrap up, Professor Yang, I quickly do want to get your take as well. Do you think this will set a precedent for other large companies?
Probably yes, but I'm a bit ambivalent about it. I'm not sure if this is a good move for the country as a whole. Already, companies like Hyundai Motors and Kakao are talking about this, but first problem, not every industry is making as much profit as Samsung. In fact, Samsung, this is an extraordinary case. I'm not even sure this will last beyond 2 years or so. And then secondly, we've now have the precedent that the labor will share the gains. But what about losses? Samsung Semiconductor Division, as recently as 3 or 4 years ago, they had a division loss. Now, what should the labor take part of the losses as well if they're going to take part of the gains? That's the usual economic logic, but I'm not sure if the labor will be open to taking that type of a risk, and that creates a distortion in the investment in payment that I'm not sure that could be overcome easily. And then, as I mentioned, well, for, say, potential entrepreneurs or investors, well, why should they take? Why should they invest or create firms if the one side takes a lot of the benefits, but none of the losses? While I, the investor or the entrepreneur, have to take the losses. So even now, younger people do not want to create firms, do not want to take the entrepreneur, but they want to go into a good company and just earn salaries. And that means, in the longer term consequences, we may have less firms, less dynamic economy, less jobs. So this may have a very big consequences in the future. But for now, this may only apply to Samsung in the short run, because Samsung's going to be the only company which makes massive enough profits to have problems like this.
Well, that's all we have time for today. My thanks to Professor Yang Jun-suk. Thank you so much, Professor Yang.
Thank you.
And Professor Sung Se-ryeon, thank you so much for your insights, Professor Sung.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 stock market update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index spiked 606.64 points, or 8.42% on Thursday, to close at 7,815.59. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 49.9 points, or 4.73%, to close at 1,105.97. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets and handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Alana.
Daniel, what's our starting point today?
The Supreme Court reversed a lower court ruling that criminalized tattooing by non-medical professionals.
Okay, so fill us in on the significance of this latest ruling.
So Thursday's ruling comes in more than three decades. The court remanded the cases of two people who had been fined in both the first and second trials for giving tattoos in violation of the Medical Act, with instructions consistent with an acquittal. It sets a new legal precedent ahead of the legalization of the practice next year.
So what exactly will change for tattoo artists under the new law?
The Tattooist Act passed by the National Assembly last year and takes effect in October 2027, legalizes tattooing by non-medical professionals. A major change is dating back to 1992, a Supreme Court ruling classified tattooing as a medical act. Non-medical tattooists face potential criminal punishment for practicing the craft.
And what were some of the factors that helped bring about the changes?
Well, the top court said tattooing was practiced widely even before medical professionals with specialized medical knowledge emerged, adding that successful tattooing does not require a level of medical knowledge and experience comparable to that of medical professionals. But the court did note that violators of conditions stipulated in criminal law or public hygiene law will face criminal punishment.
Well, it's certainly a major shift after more than three decades, and I'm sure a really big relief for many tattoo artists who've been long working in kind of a legal grey area. Dana, let's move on to our next story now.
It's been revealed that fabricated evidence was used to accuse actor Kim Soo-hyun of dating a minor.
So it's been quite some time since we heard any updates related to this case involving the actor and a young actress who took her own life. Do fill us in on the details.
A local media outlet reported on Thursday, police concluded that allegations that Kim Soo-hyun dated late actress Kim Jae-ron when she was a minor were false, and that Kim Se-hee, who runs a controversial YouTube channel, used AI-fabricated material against Kim Soo-hyun in what he presented as evidence back in 2025. A text messages exchanged between the actors dates back to 2016, but investigators believe the conversation was not between the two actors and that the YouTube channel had used names in the text messaging chat logs that were edited to identify Kim Soo-hyun as the conversation partner and the audio manipulated using AI too.
And do we know of any possible motivation behind these allegations that dealt a potentially, you know, career-ending blow to the actor?
Investigators believe that Kim Se-hee was driven by the goal of financial gains, including elevating his channel's popularity and revenue, and that he distributed false info while knowing that Kim Soo-hyun was never involved in an inappropriate relationship with the deceased actress when she was a minor. He is not alone, as the lawyer working for the family of the late actress is seen as an accomplice to the crime for providing materials and supporting the criminal act in an organized and planned manner.
So what comes next in this related investigation?
The Seoul Central District Prosecutor's Office filed a pretrial detention warrant for Kim Se-hee on Wednesday for violating the Act in Special Cases concerning the punishment of sexual crimes, citing risk of flight and destruction of evidence. The warrant review hearing will take place next Tuesday at the Seoul Central District Court. As for Kim Soo-hyun, the actor is still receiving psychiatric treatment.
Let's move on now to our final story of the day.
All-day project member Annie's graduation from Columbia University this week has been garnering a lot of attention.
Well, is there any particular reasons behind this level of interest in the Idol singer's academic accomplishments?
Well, any Korean Idol singer that's graduating from a prestigious overseas university would definitely gain some attention. But another reason why Annie turns head is her family connections. She is the great-granddaughter of the late Lee Byung-cho, the founder of Samsung, also the granddaughter of Shinsegae Group chairperson Lee Myung-hee. So it's no mystery that someone born with a silver spoon pushing boundaries and working hard to excel in both academics and musical careers will get a lot of attention.
Now, for listeners who maybe aren't so familiar with Annie and her group All Day Project, get us better acquainted.
All Day Project is a relatively new group that debuted last June. Annie made her K-pop debut with the five-member co-ed team, comprising of young artists who were already active and as solo artists in their respective fields. The team took a brief hiatus, though, and Annie decided to use the time to focus on her studies. Now that she's earned her degree in art history and visual arts, the band is likely to band together again and make a comeback soon.
And that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thanks so much, Daniel, for bringing us all the stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is pianist Son Yeguan. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
To our weekly segment, Explore Korea, our time to adventure across the peninsula and uncover hidden stories and cultural gems. And guiding us this week is our culture critic, An Jae-woo. Hi, Jae-woo.
It's a pleasure, Alana, and welcome back.
Yeah,
it's been a while,
but
still, yeah. Okay.
I'm so happy to be back and so happy to have you back as well.
Thank you so much.
Jae-woo, who or what are we going to be talking about this week?
Okay, so today we're going to talk about an artist who's, let me put it this way, a quasi-unsung hero of Korean contemporary art. And what I mean by quasi-unsung hero is that while he's cultivated a pretty impressive exhibiting career so far, I still believe he deserves way much more recognition and widespread acclaim, as do a healthy number of other art critics and curators based here in Korea. I personally think he'll be well appreciated overseas as well due to the universal subject matter of his works, as well as his exquisite world-class technique. In short, he's both philosophically and technically such a great artist. So, Alana, it's my utmost pleasure to present to you and our listeners the wonderful An Jun-young.
An Jun-young. Now, listeners, I did double-check before we started. No relation
to that's right. No nepotism. We don't do things like that over here. Mm-mm.
But this he does sound like the kind of artist whose work speaks on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. It sounds like he's technically refined. But as you just mentioned, Jae, also dealing with themes that can travel beyond Korea.
Yes.
Before we dive more into his work and what makes you feel that he deserves wider recognition, let's first talk about his latest exhibition.
My pleasure. So the title of this amazing show is Black Eyelids, or 검은 눈꺼풀 in Korean. The exhibition runs through May 31st. The venue is one of my favorite galleries, and not just Korea, but all the countries I've lived and worked in so far. Hashtag Doroshi Salon. Now, FYI number one, Doroshi Salon resides in the Samcheongdong area of the Jongno-gu district here in Seoul. And yes, as I often say, we're talking about the very Samcheongdong, which is Korea's primary art district. Mm-hmm. FYI number 1.1, if you will. Technically speaking, the gallery is not in Samcheongdong, but Palpangdong, the neighboring neighborhood of Samcheongdong. But of course, you ask anybody who's in the Korean art scene, they'll all say, Palpangdong, that's just part of Samcheongdong. That so-called greater Samcheongdong area, if you will, right? So, but technically, yes, it is in Palpangdong. FYI number two, Doroshi is usually the Korean way of saying and writing the English name Dorothy, like Dorothy Gale in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, right? Mm. But not today. You see, Doroshi in the literature of the gallery is a name coined by Lee Min-shin, the director of Doroshi Salon. It's a combination of three Korean words, namely Do, which means picture, or in a broader sense, art. Then comes Lo, which means road, and finally Shi, which means time. So the combination of the three, Doroshi, means the time of your taking the road to art. Right? And the road here is not necessarily the yellow brick road, if you know what I mean. Yes, and in English, Doroshi is officially spelled D-O-R-O-S-S-Y. So keep that in mind when you do an online search. It's on the third floor of the White Building, literally right next to the Samcheong police box. So it's very easy to find, pay a visit, and of course enjoy the rest of the beautiful neighborhood as well. For more information on the gallery and the exhibition, please visit the gallery's Naver blog at Doroshi_art or on social media, Doroshi Salon on Instagram and Facebook. Once again, it's spelled D-O-R-O-S-S-Y. SSY.
I love that, that even the gallery name has its own little story behind mm-hmm. it. And Jay, for someone who never, ever likes to pick favorites, the fact that you're saying that this is one of your favorite galleries, I mean,
that's right.
Huge praise in mm-hmm. itself. So the exhibition, again, is Black Eyelids. And just to be clear for anyone searching online, that's Dorothy with two S's, not Dorothy from The Wizard
that's
of Oz.
Right.
Now that we have that covered, let's dive a bit more, of course, into the artist himself.
Okay, so An Jun-young was born in 1984, hashtag George Orwell, here in Korea. He currently lives and works in Seoul. He earned his bachelor's degree from the College of Art and Design at Seoul Tech, which is the official abbreviation for the Seoul National University of Science and Technology. Now, I just said Seoul National University of Science and Technology, right? A quick footnote. Seoul Tech is not the natural sciences and engineering colleges at SNU, Seoul National University. Seoul Tech and SNU are two different universities. Mm. And far more importantly, in the context of today's Explore Korea, Seoul Tech's art college happens to be a very prestigious art school here in Korea.
Okay.
Now, after graduating from Seoul Tech in 2011, An Jun-young won his first solo show opportunity in 2013. It quickly established him as a then must-know emerging artist, and the rest is history, exhibiting his works year after year at a healthy number of galleries here in Korea and a few overseas. He's been invited to a significant number of art residency programs as well, and some of his works are in a few noticeable public art collections, including the Art Bank of Korea's National Museum of Modern and Contemporary Art.
So that gives us a really good picture of An Jun-young's background. Mm-hmm. He's built a strong career since his first solo show in 2013. He's since had regular exhibitions here in Korea and abroad, several mm-hmm. residencies, and works now held in public collections, like you just mentioned, Jay, the MMCA Art Bank.
Which is like the collection here in Korea, right?
Important context there. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit more about his craft.
Okay, so An Jun-young is best known for his black ink and graphite drawings. He's an absolute master of aesthetically commanding black, white, and the infinite shades of gray. Now, meanwhile, some of his works involve paints of other colors as well. And in terms of subject matter, it's pretty heavy. Well, in a nutshell, in an array of different ways, An Jun-young profoundly discusses the issue of human anxiety, especially as a reaction to the dichotomy of life and death. Now, one thing that I didn't mention when we went over his bio is the part I saved for now, how anxiety has always been a crucial part of his life. However, I do also want to highlight that, I mean, if you just meet him in person, he's like the nicest, sweetest, most humble person you can ever come across. So he's that kind of person. So unless you have like an in-depth, more personal mm-hmm. conversation with him, you'll never guess that, you know, anxiety has been that much of an issue in his personal life, right? And if we take a look at the relationship of that and his craft, right? It really makes us ask rather simple yet very, very serious questions. For example, why do we suffer anxiety in the first place anyways, mm-hmm. right? And if you think about it, one thing that we can understand is maybe or very likely it's due to the fundamental fact that human beings, after all, are mortals, right? The mortality of human being. And because, again, we're not machines and we can so easily get hurt, if not get killed, these kind of issues, right? It always makes us kind of understand that if we don't keep our anxiety at a certain level, that could be a threat, mm-hmm. right? So that's one way to understand this, especially through the craft of this wonderful artist. And it also reminds us of how, in one way, you can understand human beings being very powerful beings. But in another way, we are mortals, and therefore we are also fundamentally fragile, right? I think that's another thing that we can understand in a rather aesthetic way through the craft of An Jun-young. And speaking of fragility, it's not just about body, it's also about soul. And we have this question, of course, the older we get, we kind of realize that, when we were younger, trust wasn't that much of a mm-hmm. social issue, like, for example, in kindergarten or elementary school, right? But then you go to middle school, you go to high school, you go to college, and especially the school of life, right? One of the major lessons that you learn from the school of life is what? Trust, honesty, these kind of things are very, very scarce and very, very valuable. And because they're so scarce, right, it really brings up that, again, social nature of anxiety as well, right? So when you already have anxiety at a personal level, and then you go through socialization, and now it's not just personal, but also social. As an adult, right, this artist being now in his early 40s, I think it's safe to say that he has a very interesting understanding on this particular subject matter. Mm-hmm. But again, he's just so much of a talented artist. He's so clever in the way of how he discusses it in a non-verbal artistic fashion. Right now, let's get to the part of dichotomy of life and death. Right, what is the irony of this particular dichotomy? Right, it's that life and death cannot biologically coexist. Right, if you're alive, you're alive. Mm-hmm. If you're dead, you're dead. However, philosophically and potentially metaphorically, it can. Right, why? Because life always entails death, especially when you're mortal, and vice versa. When you die, your body dissolves into little pieces, and that gives life to newer generations. Mm-hmm. That's just how things are, right? So, another thing that we can understand about this dichotomy at the philosophical level is that every now and then we come across people who give you the idea that, wow, that person is really biologically alive. That's why we just shook hands and said hello, exchanged business cards, things of that nature. But you get to know that person, you know, a little better, and now you gradually realize, that person, biologically alive, maybe psychologically not so much. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean, mm-hmm. right? Because maybe they're not that much trustworthy, or they're just going through a rather difficult time. So you're like, wow, is that person like The Walking Dead, so to speak, right? And when you appreciate An Junyoung's work with that kind of an understanding of not just on art, but life in general, mm-hmm. I think it's very easy to realize two things. Number one, An Junyoung, not just the artist An Junyoung, but the human An Junyoung, has a very profound understanding on this issue. And number two, because he's such a clever and talented artist, the way how he expresses these issues, right? It's a very cold issue, but he ironically expresses them in such a warm way because his artistry is just that much at a high level. So it actually soothes you artistically in that sense. So I would say that's another kind of an interesting dichotomy, right? Mm. And it's an interesting contrast. But again, in art, some of the weirdest, uncanniest contradictions actually make more sense than the real.
Mm-hmm. So An is best known for his black ink, his graphite drawings, powerful works built from black, white, and as you said, Jay, you know, countless shades of grey. Mm. But earlier you said his technique is as significant as his subject matter. Tell us how so.
Yeah, just for the sake of time, I'll just put it in the smallest nutshell possible. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be an art critic to understand this. I could safely say that for anyone, you just take a look at his work and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe this is even a human being, mm-hmm. because it's just so meticulous. It's just so down to detail. It's just so ridiculously good, if you will, right? And it really reminds me, this will be my last comment regarding the relationship between his technique and subject matter, right? His overall craft. It really reminds me of the famous quote, art should comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable, by the great Mexican poet Cesar Cruz, mm-hmm. right? And I think a fantastic example of this quote would be the wonderful art of An Junyoung.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where we have to leave it for this week's Explore Korea. Our thanks to culture critic An Jae-yoo for introducing us to the work of An Junyoung and his exhibition Black Eyelids, now on view at Dorsey's Salon in Samcheongdong until May 31st. So listeners, still a little bit of time to go and see it for yourself. Thank you as always, Jae-yoo.
My pleasure.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24, but we'll be back with more of the stories shaping life here in Korea and beyond. I've been your host, Alana Hill. Thank you for joining us. And until tomorrow, take care and goodbye.